Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. This is Fascinating Ohio, a show that introduces you to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. Commune is an exciting vegan and vegetarian restaurant that focuses on the way we perceive plant-based food. This atypical and innovative plant-based restaurant will make you forget all about meat with its globally inspired high-concept dishes that are as beautiful as they are delicious. Joe Galati opened the restaurant in 2018, and he joins us now, the owner of Commune, the co-owner of Commune, Joe Galati. Welcome, Joe.
Welcome, Amy. Thank you.
So tell us, let's start with how your restaurant got its name and how that name reflects the business goals.
Yeah, that's an interesting story, I guess. It comes up quite a bit as people are always like, how do you say it? How do you pronounce it? Where's the other M? I think the original concept, the co-owner Brooke and I had this idea of a kind of like vegetarian food something probably back in 2015. And at the time, it was going to be more of like a kind of plant-based sandwich shop idea, more based around some Vietnamese like banh mi's and things that we were really enjoying that we couldn't find because we were both vegetarian at the time. And it was called Rao. And then that was the original idea. And then once we started actually getting things rolling, looking for spaces. We found the current location that we're at right now in Parsons. And that kind of kickstarted this like larger concept, something we didn't think was going to be happening for, you know, years down the road. So that larger concept was like, okay, well, we're switching gears. It's no longer about these like Vietnamese inspired dishes. It's now going to be more of a holistic look at food, cuisine, culture, all that. And the big thing was we were trying to like think of words that really communicated gathering, hosting people together, and commune was one of the words that we felt like really helped illustrate. And I think we were back and forth on just layouts looking at it. And there was something about the two M's that just threw us off. Honestly, we looked at it.
You didn't like the vibes of the two M's?
It really was something just like visually.
Yeah, okay.
We were just like, I don't know. And then someone we know kind of recommended like, hey, why don't you just drop one of the M's? What you're doing is weird enough. Like no one's gonna, it's not gonna matter. That guy knew a thing or two about branding. So we tested it and it was like, wow, that actually feels right.
Yeah.
So from there on, we kind of said, yeah, it's commune and here we go.
Yeah. Well, once you became more popular in Columbus, I think everyone figured out how to say it, but how did they used to say it before?
I would say there's still like a lot of commune out there, which is fine. Like,
yeah,
I'm not going to police
enough.
Somebody on like how to say the name. It doesn't really matter. It's like, hey, just come in and have a good time. But yeah, it's I would say like the official terminology would be just like commune.
Yeah, well, and you're inventing your own word, kind of. Yeah. So commune takes an exciting approach to plant-based cuisine. Do you have a favorite dish that you serve?
Favorite one right now. Yeah, we have a bolognese right now that is one of my favorites. We've had versions of it kind of throughout the history of commune, but it's something that's always been like near and dear to my heart. That's one that I've just really, I don't know, it just, my memory just kind of goes back to 2018, the before times, I suppose, and just like, it just really takes me back. I think there's things that we're well known for as well. It's like our crispy rice, which we've kind of recently kind of brought back, something we had when we first opened and was kind of back and forth intermittently, but was like a kimchi, egg, avocado dish that's always been like a huge fan favorite amongst the Columbus community and everywhere else too. I feel like I can't escape the city without someone saying like, are you going to bring the crispy rice back? The one with egg and avocado?
And you have, is it on your menu right now?
We have, yeah. It's back now.
Okay.
Our bread and spread that we've had since more or less the beginning of the restaurant has also been wildly popular. I think it's the type of thing where we get used to it because we see it in the restaurant so much. But whenever I come back and actually sit down to eat, I'm always like, man, this is really good.
Okay. So you are vegetarian and vegan. Most of your dishes can be made vegan. Is that right?
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. And did you, at one time, were you completely vegan, or has it evolved a little bit? I'm trying to remember.
Yeah, no, it's depending on the time and depending on the chef and just what we are doing. I think the menu can like skew maybe all vegan, mm-hmm. or like mostly can be made vegan. I think where we've landed is it's the main idea, I guess, is vegetarian. And then we try to make as much of that as we can vegan as well, like that have good vegan substitutes, things that we can accommodate for. There might be a dish or two that is like strictly vegetarian. Mm. But I think our goal ultimately is to, you know, kind of cast a wide enough net.
You say on your website that your food is globally inspired and locally sourced. So what does that mean to be worldly and close to home at the same time?
I think the benefit, well, I guess like where we've built commune is that there are many cultures that, you know, have so many like vegetables as kind of the root of the cuisine. I mean, so trying to stick to just, I mean, like, I don't think an American restaurant would just be a vegetarian. You know, there's not enough, I guess, like cultural glue there. But it's really just kind of like looking across the, you know, entire world of just like cultures, cuisines that have like existed for a long time, and then seeing what we've personally loved about them, what we think makes sense, what can kind of be translated through our lens. And I think over time, again, like depending, so much of commune has been evolving over the last 7 years, and each chef kind of brings their own preferences, their own flavors, palettes, all that. So it's like depending on the time of the year, and when, you know, era of commune, it may have shifted to be, you know, slightly more Asian, slightly more European, slightly more Mediterranean. So it kind of like really skews. But at the end of the day, for us, it's just so many cultures have really good ideas of what to do with vegetables, as they have for a long time. So we kind of pulled that for inspiration.
Yeah. Americans might have, vegetables are a second class citizen here in America.
Third class, really. It's definitely the afterthought, the steamed broccoli on the plate, you know.
Yeah. So an important part of the commune menu is the cocktail bar as well. Can you tell us what root to stem cocktails are? How are they different than a typical cocktail?
I mean, we really just try to utilize as much, I don't know, I don't want to say like waste necessarily, but like things that we can between the food program and the bar program, to make sure that things also kind of line up a little bit better. So depending on the season and depending on the time and like how much we can and like what may also make sense is trying to incorporate items that we have from the kitchen or what's on the current menu and how they can kind of flow into the cocktail program.
This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. And we're talking about the restaurant Commune with co-owner and co-founder Joe Galati. So before Commune, you were a creative services director of Victoria's Secret. At first glance, going from there to restaurant owner is not a straight path. So how did you end up on this path to restaurant owner?
I'll try to give the short version. Mm. I think working at Victoria's Secret, there's a lot of, it gave me a lot of travel. So it gave me a lot of insight to other countries, types of food, all that. So it kind of like broadened my ideas of what food can be, aside from just like living in Columbus. Mm. So that was, I think, huge from a kind of foundational, kind of opening your eyes to just like other cultures, all that. I think there's something about being in that kind of corporate setting that while it was definitely fascinating and, you know, fun for a time, it just was like, okay, I'm ready for the switch and ready for the change.
Mm-hmm. But to restaurants, I mean, that's...
Brooke and I had talked originally about, there's a few things that kind of came into the decision to switch to restaurants. I think with food being the vehicle, I think one was, I think what we were looking for at the time, kind of as I'm trying to like move away from the corporate world, one was a bit more autonomy. I think being able to make decisions yourself, see them like where they go without having to like run them up a very corporate ladder. Mm-hmm. So there's that. I think there's a little bit of seeing the large scale, I don't want to say waste, but there is like a bit of mm-hmm. that in when you're dealing with gigantic companies. Mm-hmm. So we're like, how do we minimize our footprint? And that was kind of a goal. And the other was the job that I had really was focused on the customer experience, which is definitely more qualitative than quantitative as far as what you kind of get out of it. So it's really hard to say, like, am I moving the needle by making the decisions? Is my entire job driven to just, you know, make things feel nice, which someone would probably say, like, oh, it's nice in here. Maybe you see sales tick up because of what we do. But there was something where I was like, I want a much more direct, like, customer interaction. So that was kind of three reasons why I decided to kind of shift over. And just food became that vehicle. I think Brooke and I at the time were hanging out a ton, and there wasn't a lot of good vegetarian around in the city.
Were you a vegetarian at the time?
Yeah.
And you were looking
so
to,
we were like,
to feed yourself?
For sure. And it's I think realistically what became Commune was just like us trying to find a place that we would want to go to. And since no one else was doing it, we're like, okay, well, I guess we'll just do it.
So the vegetarian and vegan scene in Columbus has kind of, I don't know if exploded is the right word, but it's bigger. What do you think of the vegetarian and vegan scene in Columbus? How are we doing? Are we doing better?
I don't know, actually. It's hard to say because there's probably like a pretty decent influx of people coming in to the city. I would say that generally it seems like there's a little bit less than it was in 2018 and 2017.
Really?
Okay. I think so. And I don't know if that's what that's necessarily tied to. It could be tied economically. It could be tied to just, you know, there isn't a lot of options for anyone. So I think like if you were vegan or vegetarian, you know, 5 years ago, you might still be that way. I think COVID changed a lot of how people interact, dine, all that, like what food they're finding. I think the thing with Commune too is like we've never been particularly dogmatic about why the reasons for vegetarian or vegan. It's just like, this is a restaurant, this is what we do. We make this food, this is what we think. It's not like we don't really care why you come here, whether it's a personal reason. It's, you know, diet's very personal. So to me, it could be a choice you've made. It could be a dietary restriction. It could be something you're, you know, health conscious. There's a lot of different reasons for why you may want to, you know, eat plant-based. It could just be a thing you're looking for, like a good meal, and it doesn't really matter. You know, I think the majority of our diners are probably going to be flexitarians anyway. But as far as like the community in Columbus, I think it's, it feels like it's maybe the same, maybe a little bit smaller. But that could just be anecdotal from like folks that I know of who've kind of like, kind of switch back to being a bit more omnivore, kind of eating whenever they, you know, whatever they can, whenever they want.
So you opened your restaurant in 2018 and then you survived the pandemic and you're here on the other side. Tell me about that time. Tell me just about running a business and how coming out on the other side, how you feel.
It's hard. I mean, I feel very fortunate. We just celebrated our 7-year anniversary last month. So, you know, there's been a lot of really good restaurants that have kind of come and gone, you know, that, you know, opened up around the time that we did. And it's really just, I don't know, it's COVID is, it's hard to think it's been 5 years already since then, going on six. So it always feels weird around March every year. I'm kind of like this weird trauma response to like, oh, geez.
Yeah, a little PTSD every
year.
Yeah,
a little bit.
Yeah.
But it was just a tough time. And I know everyone was going through it. I think, you know, even initially when we were thinking about the idea of a restaurant, it's like, okay, well, retail is kind of a thing. It feels like that's slowing down and changing very dramatically. But food, everyone needs to eat. And you don't really think about some kind of black swan event where like people can't be close to each other, right? So that kind of really changed the idea of what we felt with the restaurant and then just kind of coming back. It just, I mean, the whole thing was incredibly difficult, you know, doing the best you can. And at the end of the day, it's, you know, we create these businesses. We also want to support the people that are kind of working in them. And just like that was like some of the hardest parts was kind of how do we handle staffing, old staff, new staff, the precautions, everything. It just was a nightmare.
Well, fast forwarding to today, how are you doing with the economy now? Are you busy every night? Do tariffs impact your business?
Tariffs for sure impact our business. I think tariffs impact every business right now. I know, I mean, there isn't a week that goes by where I'm not hearing about something else increasing in price. But I think as far as like busyness, like we're like anything else, it's like restaurants are just incredibly, it feels like it's been just inconsistent, which is kind of the case for most, I'm sure, businesses where like you have great days, you have normal days, you have kind of soft days. But it's also like the economy is in a very weird position right now. And mm-hmm. I think we all feel it. And I think we're just trying to make sure that people who come in have a great time, have a good experience, can get something that they're not quite going to make at home, kind of show them another kind of side of what dining and cuisine can be, you know, kind of an atmosphere you don't typically see in Columbus. And I hope that everyone kind of like leaves feeling satisfied.
You know? And your restaurant is an interesting place. Can you tell me the impact the building has had on your business?
I can tell you that I probably wouldn't design a restaurant that way again. So it was like an old adult bookstore on the bottom, and the upstairs was like two residential units. So the way that we ended up kind of converting it is that the downstairs is the dining room. The upstairs is the kitchen with an office and like a little prep area. So it just means that we're running around up and down a lot every night.
A lot of stairs.
A lot of stairs.
Your staff gets their steps in. And then just to end on, tell me about your staff. How do they shape the restaurant?
That's a great question. I mean, I always look at the staff as they're the ones who are really keeping Commune running. I mean, they are for sure, like, it's the interactions that you're having every day with them. I'm constantly talking to them, trying to bounce ideas off of them. What should we be thinking about? What are they seeing? I've been hosting the last couple of years, so like if you come into Commune, you'll probably see me downstairs. Mm-hmm. But it's just really about, it's a team effort. These things really always are. And that's why I don't want to take, you know, all the credit. It's like, yeah, we've helped create this thing, but it really has been like an entire team, you know, past, present, future, who've really kind of like made Commune what it is.
We have been talking about the restaurant Commune with co-owner Joe Galati. Joe, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Amy.
And coming up, we're going to talk with an artist who puts rhythm and movement into her art. That is when Fascinating Ohio from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. And this is Fascinating Ohio, a show that introduces you to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. She was born in Taiwan, raised in Belize, and attended college in Canada. Now living in Columbus, this artist puts the rhythm of her worldly movement into her art. Yanni Sheng is an artist who works out of the High Road Gallery and Studios in Worthington, where she creates art and reflects on her experiences. Welcome to All Sides, Yanni.
Thank you so much for having me, Amy.
So you've lived many different places all around the world. What drew you to Columbus?
Oh, goodness. Initially, when I first moved here, because I fell in love with someone from Columbus.
So that person brought you here, but then what made you stay?
Oh, actually, when I stayed, it's because when I realized the rich history and the cultural, you know, aspect in Columbus, it's just fascinating.
So how has moving and travel affected or inspired your artwork?
I think moving and travel really does help me and feel inspired. When you engage with different people around the world, you learn something. When you speak to them, just a little conversation, you walk away with a whirl of like experience almost, you know, because you're reading their facial expression, you're engaging what they want to talk about or how's your day. You initially get a good idea how the environment feels around different areas when you live in.
How many years have you been in Columbus?
Let's see, since 2016.
Okay.
Yeah.
So do you think Columbus is home forever, or are you going to travel?
Oh, forever. Absolutely. Yeah, okay. Yeah, forever. But definitely I would like to give myself opportunity to travel and visit different places in the United States. I mean, once again, I can't stress enough to a lot of people that United States is huge. There's cultural all across, and you know, you got to learn about it. Even you're in the United States, when you go see different places, you take in what is available there and the culture, the building, the history, the people, all that.
Whenever I was doing some research about you, I learned some new word. Can you tell us what Natsuki is? Am I saying that right?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Natsuke.
Yeah, okay, Natsuke. So I'm saying it wrong. I'm sorry.
Too. It's good. Natsuke is actually a traditional small miniature sculpture. Mm. And it's carved back in Japan. What it does is when you use it, that they carve this little about inch and a half or 1 inch miniature sculpture of different, could be mythical creatures, could be everyday life, like mm-hmm. a broom or something like that. But it's so tiny that it's use it as a toggle. So you take it, you put it with the rope, you put it right between your belt. So obi is what they call it, the Japanese belt they use to keep the kimono together. Mm-hmm. So you can hold, the little sculpture actually helped to keep the little pouch attached with the rope. So you can have money, medicines, or smoking pouch.
So rather than just a boring bead,
you
carve it and make it interesting.
Yes.
Okay. And so that's a part of your work. You do those?
Yes, yeah. I do. Yeah. I did some research on that area and try to inspire myself and really dig into my Japanese background and be inspired and take it and represent it again.
This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we are talking with artist Yanni Sheng. So your art also has a flowing, sort of undulating look to it. I believe you even did a whole series entitled Flow. Can you tell me what inspired you with the flow? Yeah.
Wow. The flow is actually all, could be almost anything. Flow in and out could be used in languages, but when it comes to flow in art, especially my area of painting my work, is to think about the rhythm and the body itself mm-hmm. that has energy, mm-hmm. you know, and how do we move into position like everyday walking. But I practice yoga, so mm-hmm. I think of myself like when I move and flow into a different pose, yoga pose, how do I do that? And how do my muscle reacts and it works and how the energy works? So I like to depict them in colors and emerging them very fluidly and organically.
And another type of work you do is carving into linoleum. And
yes.
They look beautiful, but also very intricate. Can you talk to me about that process?
Okay. Yeah. Carving linoleum, any type of carving is so different from painting. Because mm-hmm. when you paint, if you make a mistake, you can layer it over, mm-hmm. you know, cover it up. But when you do carving, because you're using chisels and gougers, you're unable to do that. So what you do, when you make a cut, you want to be as precise as possible. And if you make a mistake, it's hard to glue it back.
So you have to start over if you make a mistake.
Or try to fix it. You know, mm-hmm. there's little tricks for fixing it, but it's not the same.
So you've mentioned carving little animals. You mentioned carving linoleum, and you mentioned painting. What kind of artist are you? Are you a painter? Or are you a carver?
I don't know. I just enjoy to be inspired by things that are around me and people, you know, and like you, having a chat with you, I'm so inspired being in this studio right now and looking at everything is just so fascinating in my perspective.
Is my radio studio going to turn into artwork?
Oh, I think so. I just feel like this building, and then it's just like for the work I'm doing now is kind of like that, like places that imbue histories and imbue stories and is interactive with the human every day.
What artwork are you making now?
Right now is the carving, especially. Mm. It's all about the Ohio architecture. Mm. Spaces that tell story and captures history. And one of them I have done just recently is Ohio Theater. Carving the outside of Ohio Theater, even with the few buildings that are attached to it. Mm. And people are walking and just presenting a different perspective how art can be looked at.
Carving into linoleum?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how big are we talking?
I think the one I have is 28 by 19.
Okay. 28 yeah. inches?
28 inches by okay. 19. Or
I was like 28
by...
feet.
Oh, no. Well, that would be great.
That would be a lot.
Bring
yeah.
out the roller.
Well, you also, I found from another story about you, you have tattoos on both your arms.
Yes, I do.
And is one side Japanese and one side
yes,
Chinese?
Yes, it does. So, oh.
Okay. That's how you can, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So on my left side of arm is actually a Japanese koi. Mm. And it's designed by Jamer Lindsay back when I was living in Vancouver Island. So what I love about it is that it tells a story and I'm able to capture my backgrounds. Because it reminds me every time when I look at it, I say, look at this cute koi. I love koi. But I'm like, it's Japanese koi. Mm-hmm. There's history behind it. Kois eat lots of bugs when they're in the flooded rice paddy field. So that's what they use them for. Instead of crayfish, you have koi that goes around, eat the bugs, and get rid of the pests around, kind of pest control around the rice field.
Mm, yeah. Okay. and so that, and then that's one side, and then the other side is it Chinese?
Yes, it is Chinese. And this one is a food dog, so it's a protective concept. It's an animal that you often seen when you're by the temple, Asian temples, Chinese temples, or Japanese temple. There's always two lions on one on each side. Mm. And what it does is that it reminds me the fact that I'm a very protective person. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, the images is all about guarding. Mm. And the spirituality in the aspect of this kind of brings me a sense of joy that, you know, I believe I am a very protective person, I think, and it kind of reflects really well for me and also culturally my background, Chinese yeah. background from my grandfather's side.
If our listeners Google you, you can find the article that I'm talking about where you talked about the tattoos.
So yes!
you can see them since we're on the radio. But oh. Yes, but but did you design them yourself?
No, I didn't. Okay. Actually, the artist I work with, James, he passed away back in 2011. Very unfortunate. I was the last person that he tattooed. For tattooing, especially when you get a full arm, it takes a while to get them done. But when you're visiting your artist pretty much once every 2 weeks, you get to know them. You get to talk about stories and his histories and how he become what he does and music that he likes. You know, you kind of, it feels really a form of artwork on your body, but you're getting so much out of it when you walk away.
And you mentioned the koi that you have on your one arm, and you've incorporated koi like that one in your other art too. You've said that koi saved you.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Oh, yeah. Well, when I was little, I think I was around six and a half, me and my friends were playing around. My family went to visit a good friend, our family friends, that owns like a koi factory. Well, not factory. I would say like a farm. Yeah. A koi farm. And what they do is like you have a lot of big pools, like square pools with full of kois. And I remember running around in the boardwalk, just hanging out, just chasing someone else, but there was a wet puddle on the floor. So all of a sudden, I just slipped. I fell in the water, and I didn't even know the koi pond. I did not know how to swim. So falling into the koi pond was a bit of a shock for me. I couldn't swim. I tried to hold on, and I grabbed a piece of board or somewhere that I was held onto a wood. And then all of a sudden, I felt the koi just swarm all around me. It's an incredible experience, and they're slippery, but they're pushing. They're literally, I don't know if they're trying to eat me, but at the time as a kid, I was like, oh my goodness, I get to step on you. So that's how I feel a bit, like, you know, being saved by koi. Because
they pushed you up out of the water?
They pushed me off the water.
Like, wow.
Yeah, so it was kind of like, oh my goodness.
That's a great story.
I was much lighter then. I'm sure now it's not
the koi wouldn't save you now.
Yeah.
I also read that you are an instructor at the McConnell Art Center and also the Mansfield Art Center. Talk to me about teaching art to others. How is that for you?
Well, I think it's very rewarding. That's the first thing I gotta say. teaching has always been something that always in the back of my mind. But I was born with a learning disability. Mm. And I also have a few anxiety background due to childhood trauma when it comes to education. And that is very close to my heart, once again. Like, as a kid, I was not very, I did not succeed in my curriculum careers, you know, and a lot of stuff. I was judged and discriminated for having low marks. Mm. And the way I was taught in Asia was very different back in the 80s. So it was a lot scarier compared to now. And I think that gives me a whole new sense of how I can contribute to in teaching to help kids grow and find art to be fascinating and something that they is accessible for them and help them to express their feeling as well or just enjoy of creating.
Do you teach young kids or are we talking older kids? Like what? And are you teaching them painting? Like what are we carving linoleum with with 6-year-olds?
Oh, you'll be surprised. Yeah. If you're 3, I could get it. I mean, after I saw a video back in a long time ago, I saw an Amazon child is able to use a machete and he's only 3 years old chopping wood. That threw me off. I mean, that imagery-wise is so intimidating to me. I could never imagine our North American kids holding a machete and try to cut wood, you know. That's kind of scary for me. But then it almost gave me a sense like, wow, they're capable. Mm-hmm. We're born with the ability of learning and we're able to, you know, copy and reinterpret it the way how it works for us. So when it comes to art in general, when I teach kids, it's all range. Mm. If you're willing to learn, I'm here for you. That's all it is. Yeah, I teach adults too. But with kids, it's really close to my heart. So I teach oil painting for children. They could start when they're like 7 years old usually or first or second grades. My background of education is secondary education. So I teach a little bit older kids. I enjoy the secondary education kids because they have full of emotion, full of ideas, full of energy. They haven't lost that yet. By the time you hit in high school, you kind of started to chill out a little bit more, you know? Yeah.
Did you ever think, you know, when you were a kid struggling in school, did you think that you would have a life as an artist?
No, I did not, actually. I knew I always love art. I always love drawings and creating and making stuff. I never thought I would have it as a career. I thought about, hey, maybe it'll be great one day, but I never really think that will be the case for me. For an Asian girl, you know, a lot of time you have a family, maybe it is traditional, they want you to nurse, doctor, typical. Lawyer, maybe. Yeah. Businessman is more common.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you found your niche as an artist, right?
I do. Yeah. I love it.
Yeah. So the architecture series you're doing about the history of Columbus, is that something you're still working on? Is it going to be a show somewhere?
Yes. I'm aiming for 2028. And once again, my studio is over at Hyro Gallery, and it's right in Worthington. I work with 12 different artists in the same gallery, and we all have our studio room. And I'm very fortunate because when I get bored, I get to talk to them and then get ideas and then, you know, just engaging with like-minded people that helps to facilitate my growth. And especially with carving, it's a lot of time just in your own head. So it's nice to work with, you know, having a studio mate with you, would chat with you. And it could be about anything, you know, like that. For carving, I have to say that I have carved since I was little, and I love different type of artwork, and I don't believe I should limit myself to just one, like one type of art that I will only pursue. I believe as a creative person, perhaps we could grab things that inspire us and then create art from it, you know? I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. I was just going to say, we've been talking with artist Yanni Sheng, and I want to thank you so much for your time today. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
And coming up, we are going to talk to a lover of world travel who is helping others find beauty and excitement in the unknown. That's when Fascinating Ohio from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. This is Fascinating Ohio, a show that introduces you to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. When it comes to travel, tourism-heavy areas can have their appeals, but things like overcrowding and pollution can make you want to find somewhere a bit more unknown. WinCafe Global Travel is a travel agency that helps you find beauty and excitement in the unknown, setting up elaborate itineraries for tourists to make the most out of their international trips while also giving back to the countries that they visit. Joining us now is WinCafe Global Travel's founder, Kristen WinCafe. Welcome to All Sides, Kristen.
Thank you so much.
So what drew you to be a part of the tourism industry?
I've always loved travel. I've always loved learning about other cultures, other people, the way other people live. And my career before I joined the travel industry was in international development and human rights programming. Mm-hmm. So I got to see a lot of different countries, the way people live. And it just, like, it's always fascinated me. And so when I learned about an opportunity to take what I know from international development and translate it into travel, and so use my passion for travel as a way to help spur development in these developing countries, I was like, wow, that's like the dream, is being able to combine, you know, what you love, what you actually enjoy, with something that really makes you feel fulfilled and makes you feel like you're doing something good for the world.
So what is the story behind starting WinCafe Global Travel? So you, I mean, that's one thing to like travel and want to help your friends, you know, like be like, oh, I can tell you where to go and what to do. But then to start a whole business around it, I mean, that's a big jump.
Yeah. So growing up, we always planned our own travel. My family, we were big travelers from a very young age. I mean, we were bopping around. And then when I was in elementary school, my dad got a sabbatical from work, so we spent many months over in Europe. So I think it was always just a part of my daily life in a way it isn't necessarily for a lot of people. And when I learned that travel agents were still a thing, I wasn't aware. I mean, I think a lot of people who are used to planning their own travel, they don't really realize that's still a career that's out there. So I learned about it, and I learned that it's not just about, oh, you know, someone calls in and says, I need a flight to Greece, can you book it for me? What it actually can be about is someone comes in and says, I want a trip that my husband and I can take to help us reconnect, that can help us, you know, feel alive, feel adventurous, feel romance. And I take those ideas and the feelings that they want, or someone in my position could take those ideas and the feelings and use, you know, dream things up, be creative, design a full trip for them that they don't even know they're asking for. So, I mean, I think it literally was within a week of learning that the profession even existed, I'd started the business. I was like, I need to find, you know, the best people to partner with to do it. I was already an independent consultant, so I was already kind of running my own business. So that side of things was very natural to me. But yeah, I think just it really was just learning it existed. I immediately knew, like, that's what I should be doing.
Okay, so give me an example. My husband and I want to go on an adventure and reconnect. Where are you sending me?
Yeah. So the first step in our process is to learn everything we can about you. We would get on a phone call. I would ask you all sorts of questions, figure out who you are, who your husband is, why this trip, why now, what are you hoping to feel, what are you hoping to do? Do you have any like ideas in mind already? Because I want to make sure we're meeting those. But if I'm just to take it, you know, in the abstract, we could really go a lot of different ways with that. So are we going to be sending you on a safari in Botswana where you're so far removed from anything else that there's like, there's nothing to do but like be there with each other in this magical place that feels like a totally different world? Or are we going to send you, you know, to like Umbria or Tuscany, where you're going to be in those these romantic hills with the vineyards and the wine, and just like Italy for a lot of people just like symbolizes love. So it really, everything we do is really customized. So I can't just plan a trip for someone based on, you know, that little bit of information. I need to know so many more things about you.
Yeah.
And I love getting to know that. I get to talk to so many people and get to know them so well.
Okay.
It.
Okay. So I love the beach, but my husband loves the mountains. So
okay.
So how do we decide where to go? Right. We need a place where there's beach and mountains. He loves to hike. I would rather be lazy. So now where are you sending me?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, that actually kind of matches my husband and I very well. on vacation, I'm slowly changing him, but he likes to like go, see everything, do everything. And I want to just like relax. I want to like experience the place, feel it. So, I mean, a couple of places that came to my mind first would be like Turkey, where you can, you know, spend a few days in Cappadocia, enjoying, you know, the mountains that are there, hot air balloon rides, really like it's mountains. There's a lot of adventure to be had, but it still can feel incredibly relaxing. I mean, there's the hammams that you can spend some time at the spa. And then there's Bodrum just a couple hours away. That's like gorgeous beach. But there you can also, you know, relax on the beach. But there's also places to go really nearby that have this really cool ancient Roman history where he could go explore and learn. I mean, there's all the ocean adventures. So I think that would be a really good combo where you could kind of get both of what you want in both of the places, combining it together.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about Wincaffey Global Travel with founder Kristen Wincaffey. Can you talk to me about the... because your company makes a point of factoring in carbon offsets when booking trips. And can you talk to me about that, about how you're trying to give back, you know, and maybe decrease the tourism industry's carbon footprint?
Yeah. So I'll say for us, sustainability is at the heart of what we do. It comes from my background in international development. I really want to make sure that the trips that we're planning are not only, you know, fantastic, amazing for our clients, but they also have a positive impact on the destinations that they're visiting. So we do that through a number of different ways. For us, sustainability falls into kind of three different pillars. It falls into the social, the environmental, and the economic. Okay. And so talking about the carbon offsets, that's the environmental side of things. So that's we start from the very beginning. We fully offset the carbon emissions of every single one of our clients' trips. So every trip that a client of ours will take is net neutral, net zero carbon emissions, which is just like one small way to kind of reduce the damage and the impact that travel has. But that's just reducing damage. That's not creating the positive impact. So the way that we actually go about creating the positive impact is through the social and the economic. So one of the biggest things that we do is we do our absolute best to make sure as much of what our clients are spending is staying in the destination. So that means things like choosing local hotels, local tour guides, local restaurants, local artisans, making sure our clients know that, like, if you're going to shop, try to shop here, not here where it's this big, you know, international mall, whatever. Because through my development work, I know that just the changing hands of that money, the transfer of wealth into those communities, directly into the hands of the people, can make such a huge impact on their development, on their situation. And it gives the power back to them, where then they can lead and guide their own development because they now have the resources to do so.
I recently interviewed PBS travel expert Rick Steves, and he said that his number one goal in life is to show Americans that they can travel beyond Orlando. So are you an anti-Disney Universal type person?
I am, and I'm also not. I mean, like, every parent wants, I'm a parent, I have a 2.5-year-old. Every parent wants to take their child to Disney, like, see that magic. But I think there's, I mean, first of all, there's Disney elsewhere. I mean, Disney Japan, by many of my friends who are Disney experts, is far and away better than Disney World in Orlando. So if you're going to go to Disney, like, maybe think about doing that. And then it's also just like you can see that wonder and that joy in your child through so many other things. I mean, speaking of Turkey, my first trip that I brought my daughter on when she was 9 months old was to Turkey. And she, like, in Turkey, they are, when a child is born, it's a blessing for the whole community, not just for, you know, the parents or the family. So everyone was so happy to see her, like, so welcoming, like, so excited when she was there, kind of how I imagine, you know, the characters at Disney are. So she still got this, like, absolutely incredible experience that is a whole new world for her, but is not
Pun intended, right? Okay, so whenever you are planning these trips and you're saying you want to, you know, book things locally to enhance the local community. So I'm guessing that means that you're contacting the hotel itself and not like Travelocity is not getting any of your money, right?
Travelocity is not getting your money. We have relationships with companies around the world. I'm always traveling myself. I'm attending shows to kind of make these relationships and these connections with people in the countries because they're the experts in their country. I mean, I can visit as many times as I want, and I'm never going to know everything. The people who are actually living there every day, those are the ones that you want having a hand in your trip. So I view myself as I become the expert on my clients, and I connect them with the people in the country who are the experts on the destination. And then I am the one who helps translate what they want, what they need into the actual context of the destination. And then the people who are living there are the ones who, you know, help us organize it, help us plan it, manage all the logistics, give us all the inside tips, you know, things like that.
I also read that you donate 10% of your profits to charitable causes. Can you name a few or tell me what made you decide to do that?
So, I mean, I think it's really important to know and to accept that, like, no matter what we do, travel is going to cause some harm. And so since I do want to have a net positive impact, this is just another way that we do that. So we donate 5% to a foundation called Travel for Better, which I'm the executive director of now. But it's a company that's working to change travel at an industry structural level. So my work with WinCafe Global Travel is on a per client, on a trip basis. Travel for Better is working to help educate people in the industry on how everyone can make travel more sustainable. And then 5% goes directly to grassroots local organizations. So we spend a lot of time, you know, connecting with our partners, researching and finding companies on the ground. So for example, like, we have a lot of clients who visit Costa Rica, and we're connected with a organization there that what they do is they're helping to restore the coral reefs by planting coral nurseries. So every client that we have that visits Costa Rica, 5% of our profits from their trip go to this organization. And they actually can, you know, name the little coral buds that they plant after the clients. And it's just a really great way to recognize that, like, they're traveling, they're enjoying this place, they're enjoying the coral reefs, they're going snorkeling, they're seeing these things. And then they're also having this great positive impact by helping to build it back up as well.
Well, picking a favorite travel destination can be tough for someone like you. So you can pick a favorite if you want to, or you can just tell me the most memorable trip you've taken.
I have two. One is actually from this past year, and it's Botswana. When I was maybe 10, read this book called Whatever You Do, Don't Run. That's like a humorous take on being a safari guide. Mm. And it's this guide who ended up in Botswana, and just the country is incredible. And the animals, the lodges, the people, it was just like, I mean, I thought I knew what I was getting into, but it was just like a whole different world. It was so magical. And like, I can be a little jaded. I've been so many places. I've experienced so many things that sometimes it's hard for me to feel like that magic and that joy that like, wow, this is something totally different and new. Mm-hmm. But Botswana had that. And I think even for people who've been on safari before, Botswana is something truly special.
And then we have 30 seconds for you to tell me the second one.
The second one is Slovenia. Okay. And it's just a place a lot of people don't necessarily think of when they're thinking Europe. But it was like a fairy tale. Just Ljubljana, the mountains, the wine country, just the river is so turquoise that like you think it's fake. It's just such a magical place as well.
Hmm. Well, we've been talking about international travel with Kristen Wincaffey, the founder of Wincaffey Global Travel. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
And we've been talking on Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. If you missed any part of today's show, you can listen back at WOSU.org/allsides. Subscribe to our podcast, and every episode is also in the WOSU mobile app. This is 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.